From WAMU 88.5 at American University in Washington, welcome to the Politics Hour starring Tom Sherwood. I'm Kojo Nandy. Later in today's broadcast, we'll be talking with Carl Roller. He is the chair of Advisory Neighborhood Commission 3C about a homeless shelter that's proposed for that ward in the District of Columbia. We'll also be talking with the chair of the Prince George's County Board of Education, Segun Eubanks. But first, Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom, there's a story you need to explain that was broken by our reporter here at WHUR, but here at WAMU, here at WAMU 85, Patrick Madden did the story about the director of the D.C. General Services Administration resigning. Christopher Weaver has resigned. Two staff members has been placed on administrative leave. It would appear that this has to do with infrastructural improvements at two locations, one of them the soccer stadium at Buzzard Point, the other the future southeast home of the Washington Wizards and Mystics facility. And apparently there were two bids for those infrastructure improvements, one by a local certified business enterprise, Fort Myer Construction, the other by a Rhode Island-based construction company. The Rhode Island-based company came in with a bid of $6 million. The local company, Fort Myer, came in with $16 million. It went, apparently, to the Rhode Island-based company. But Fort Myer is a major contributor to Mayor Bowser's campaigns. And apparently, the Bowser administration was interested in making sure that Fort Myer was a part of this project. We were hoping to have the city administrator on the broadcast on Monday to discuss it, but you could explain how this stuff all works.
Well, you know, Fort Myer has had any number of contracts with the city government, predating Muriel Bowser, Mayor Gray, I think Fenty, too. I don't know if it goes all the way back to Tony Williams or not. It has an established record. It also, in this particular case, had a contract proposal that was much higher, $10 million higher. And there seems to be some unusual interest from the city administrator's office into how this contract did not go to Fort Myer, but to the firm from Rhode Island. I don't have the name of that company.
Gilbane.
And so there was some discussion about it, and this all led to the resignation of Christopher Weaver, the director of the Department of General Services. The politics of this is General Weaver, I mean, excuse me, General Admiral Weaver, that's a bad mistake, Admiral Weaver had been given pretty good records of running the Department of General Services, basically does all the construction and building in the city for the city government. He abruptly resigned, and right after this meeting with the city administrator, and he wouldn't say why, he said for personal reasons. And so we all wondered whether he was sick, whether his family issues. Well, it turns out he was apparently furious over this interference, he thought, by the city administrator and the mayor's administration into this contract. So we need to know. Patrick Madden broke the story. It's detailed about a lot of the details. We don't know why the city administrator was so involved. Fort Myer, I'm sure, was upset they didn't get the contract. And it didn't get the contract, so that's where we stand now. And so I'm hoping the city administrator, who came from Alexandria, will come in and give a clearer, better description of what happened.
Because obviously there's a delicate balance that has to be struck between wanting to save the taxpayers as much money as possible on the one hand, and on the other hand, trying to make sure that a local business is involved in a project.
Minority business, community-based businesses do get preferential treatment. The mayor's office says that this agency, and the two men who are now on administrative leave, did not properly score, that they raised the total score a group could get for the contract, but did not raise the minority business aspect of the contract. And I don't get too deep in the weeds there because it gets very legal from that point on. But they're insisting that it was properly held, and the city administrator was just trying to figure out why Fort Myer was not involved. And so we'll find out maybe more on Monday if Rashad Young can come in.
Speaking of legal, Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe says it's legal this time. He individually restored voting rights to 13,000 felons. Those were those who were among the 200,000 who he had issued a blanket order restoring rights to. Those had already registered to vote. And so he said, look, I individually signed off on these 13,000, and that's what I'm going to do with the entire 200,000. Of course, the Republican legislative leaders in the Virginia State Senate had sued over the original order. They won that. The question is whether or not they'll be able to sue over what he's doing now.
Well, I think the whole issue was that each of these had to be considered individually. I just hope the governor has an automatic pen.
Yes, I read about that.
But does he have to read every one? I mean, he clearly is upset that the Supreme Court, I think it was the Supreme Court of the state, ruled that you couldn't do a blanket approval, that each one has to be addressed, and he's going to do it. He thinks it's proper for a person who has served his or her time to have the right to vote be restored. He says the complaint that it's a political move to boost the turnout for this fall for Hillary Clinton is not true. And if you look at the polls, I'm not sure it would be worth the effort, even if it were.
And on to the business at hand. Our guest is Segun Eubanks. He is the chair of the Prince George's County Board of Education. He's also director of professional educator support at the National Education Association. Dr. Eubanks, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have questions or comments for Segun Eubanks, you must have read about what's going on in Prince George's County with the school system. Give us a call, 800-433-8850. Go to our website, kojoshow.org. Watch the live video stream. Ask a question. Make a comment. Send us a tweet at kojoshow or email to kojo@wamu.org. I'd like to get to what happened at last night's Board of Education meeting, but first, let's back up. Earlier this month, Prince George's County schools were informed that they had lost a $6.3 million federal Head Start grant for early childhood programs because of deficiencies in the school system. What happened?
So Head Start regularly monitors all of its programs, and the idea of having deficiencies is not new to our program or many others. Unfortunately, the deficiencies cited in this case were particularly egregious and were based on actions taken by Head Start staff that endangered either the safety and or humility and humanity of students. So we responded and were working to correct those deficiencies. But in the middle of that process, unfortunately, at least two other significantly egregious acts took place within Head Start classrooms. And based on those acts, the Administration for Children and Families decided that they needed to terminate the grant.
Let's be a little clear on the numbers. How many people in Prince George's County, how many people or students are involved in Head Start?
About 932 students registered in Head Start programs
and
51 classrooms.
Okay, just under 1,000 mm-hmm. students.
Yes.
We had, in all these reports from the federal agency, three, five, six, a half dozen, a dozen incidents where the children were mistreated. It's not more than a dozen, right?
The reported incidents are significantly less than a dozen.
So an agency, if Head Start would not come in, I think, and would want to cancel a program for four or five or six students being mistreated, no matter how horribly they were treated, if you've got nearly 1,000 students that benefit from the program, what else is wrong with the program? There's got to be other issues. Have you reported the money? Have you got full staffing?
So our money and our staffing, and if you looked at the reports, the money and the staffing and the operations actually all passed. There were no deficiencies cited.
So there's no other issue other than the mistreatment by this half dozen or so cases?
There were two deficiencies cited that were dramatic. The first is that the first incident that happened was not properly reported. And that is a serious effort. It means
that the child with the urine.
That we, our staff, and our administrators are obligated both under the rules of the grant and also legally to report
To whom?
To the Administration for Children and Families, to the federal government. Oh, so okay. When an incident occurs, it is our obligation to both address it and to report it. The first incident was not reported, so we were cited for deficiency both for our failure to report and for the incident itself. When the other two incidents were reported, we actually were cited as having corrected our deficiency around reporting because we reported. But
didn't some of these issues happen back last spring? When did these
incidents? The first incident happened in December of 2015. And
why are we just hearing about it? Now, I think that one of the irritations, and that's why people have called for you to resign, I need an answer on that, are you going to resign, is that these things were discussed, and I think even back in March or May, I can't remember which month it was, and now we're just to this point. Why is it taking so long for it to come out?
So when these deficiencies were reported in January, were discovered in January, and when we got the report in February, we submitted, as was our requirement, forget the name of the report, but it's a report about our plan is to the Administration for Children and Families.
All right.
We sent a report of corrective actions of what we were going to be doing. They came. They had a visit with us. Most of this is standard practice and typically not public. Again, there are deficiencies that happen like this all the time. When we did not discover, certainly the board did not know about the June
additional incidents.
Until we were informed on August 12th of the notice to terminate.
And this is bad enough that your board voted last night to give up the Head Start program, and there's now a committee formed to figure out who's going to oversee it?
Right. So when...
The funding's going to continue. There's no family has to worry about Head Start, their children not being in Head Start in Prince George's County.
And you need to explain that, because if on the one hand you say you have given up the program, people will tend to assume that means that the funding is not available. Right. What it seems
exactly
that you have done is taken a course that will permit you to receive that funding.
Well, what we've done is taken a course to ensure that children, those almost 1,000 children, will have uninterrupted Head Start services throughout the 2016-17.
How will that be accomplished?
So that will be accomplished when we terminate the grant. The Administration for Children and Families will identify an interim provider of that grant.
So have one. There won't be a gap. When you terminate it, there will be somebody, some organization in place to take it.
That is correct.
It simply means that this will no longer be administered by Prince George's County Public Schools.
So I don't know if that's simply, but that's what it means. It means that $6.3 million will flow into those classrooms, but will flow through an interim provider.
Why do you even have the program to begin with? You have enough issues in the school system that would be a full-time job not to take on early education for children and Head Start program, which is very important. It's been around for a long time. You know,
Mary White Edelman likes to say Head Start works.
Right.
Yes, it does work. But I mean, why did you have it in the first place? How long has the school system had it?
The school system has had a Head Start grant for 50 years.
Hopefully that answers that. Now, hard about now, speaking of that, people have called on you to resign. This is so bad that the federal government wants to take away the program from the school system, that people are saying that it should also be bad enough for you and the chair, the vice chair.
The people who are saying that are five board members who actually wrote a letter about that, saying that they were not informed, presumably, about the June incident until they read about it in the media.
Are you resigning?
I got support from the county executive. I do not intend to resign.
And it's true for the vice chair, I think it is. Carolyn Boston,
I think. I won't speak directly for her, but to best of my knowledge, Carolyn Boston has no intention to resign as vice chair. I will say our first obligation was to ensure that the children who are going to start school on the 29th, which is Tuesday, I believe, are going to get the services that they deserve, and that was our first function. Now, once we've secured that, we are open, and I'm particularly open to a full and thorough investigation of what happened and why, and to hold people accountable at every level, including myself.
Among your obligations,
the five board members say, is to keep them informed. They are, after all, your board, to keep them informed of developments. They said, as I said earlier, they only found out about this through the news media.
So, again, we're going to, when we go through that investigation, I think that what we find is that we worked to tell our board members everything that we knew.
Is it true that last spring that this incident or this information about Head Start was in some report that the board members simply didn't read?
We gave a oral briefing to the board in executive session on April 14th of 2016.
Telling the board what?
Telling the board this was of the details of the first incident. Remember, the other incidents didn't happen.
And were there
June,
all these five so members who are calling for you to resign? Were they there? Was there a formal record of it?
There is a formal record of the details that were posted. And Sean Joseph, then the associate superintendent, was the one who gave the report. It did happen that was one of our board meetings that were poorly attended, which was unfortunate. And there's a record of that attendance as well. And then there were minutes of the policy council that were posted on board docs for the public that kind of outlined the fact that we were put on notice, the fact that these incidents had occurred, and the fact that we were working.
Allow me
on
to remind our audience that we're talking with Segun Eubanks. He is the chair of the Prince George's County Board of Education. He's also the director of professional educator support at the National Education Associations. Currently, we're talking about the county losing or appearing to lose $6.3 million in federal funds for the Head Start program. So if you tuned in while we were in the weeds there and you may not have known what we were discussing. However, if you have a question or comment, give us a call at 800-433-8850 or go to our website, kojoshow.org, watch the live video stream, ask a question, make a comment there.
Well, I do hope that the Head Start program itself is better run and more clear and more simple to the students in it than this situation. But Tracy Wilkins, who's the NBC Bureau Chief for Prince George's County, wanted me to ask you, what is your reaction to having a divided board, nearly more than a third, with a large portion of the board not believing in your leadership? I mean, that's got to undercut your ability to get anything done. You've got a busy school year ahead.
We certainly do. We have a 13-member board, and I come on this board as a lifelong educator. I'm not a politician, but I certainly have learned that boards of education have inherently political processes to them.
You had to learn that by getting on the board?
I had to learn the details of it.
Anybody could tell you that before you get there.
Absolutely, but getting into it is how you is where and how you truly learn it. And so we have differences of opinion on philosophy. We've had differences of opinion for a long time. If you look at the record of the board, if you look at the voting history of the board, I think you will see that there is we are consistently on a very high majority accord about the direction that we're headed and about the decisions that we need to make. And the fact that we voted on this grant in a 10 votes in favor, one abstention and one opposed, I think shows that when it comes
in to your opinion, what went wrong and what could have been handled differently about this?
If you could do it over again.
Yes.
So I think that there's a lot in hindsight. I think that none of us appropriately anticipated it's hard to anticipate when you see the egregious act about making a student clean up their own urine. That's a heinous enough act that it's not automatically in our mind as a pattern.
And
those teachers, there is a process in place. Those teachers are currently on administrative leave.
With pay.
Usually on administrative leave includes with pay.
Just want to make it clear to people that people aren't working because they've been accused of a horrible thing until they're getting paid.
Yes. Right. Yes. That's
the way
our system worked. When the system put its training in place, there were two pieces of training that we needed to give to our employees immediately. The first piece of training was around reporting, and that training happened immediately. We had a broader agenda of training around student safety and student and student discipline and dignity, a whole series of which was planned for this fall that clearly, if we had to do it all over again, we certainly should have gotten to our staff significantly sooner than we did. And I you know, it's hard for me to imagine that teachers already didn't know and understand that the idea that you would send a 3 or 4 year old unaccompanied down the hallway or have a student.
Well, it's one thing for teachers not to understand that. On the other hand, one gets the impression that it's possible that because you've been administering this for 50 years, nobody really said, well, okay, so we've been cited for deficiencies, but they're never going to yank our grant. We've had it for 50 years, and that may have led to a certain, I guess, lack of urgency in the response.
That's a fair question, and I don't know that the answer to that, certainly from the administrators who were handling the frontline response. I know that we felt that it was urgent enough to have the board briefed in executive session. The sense of urgency, the federal government made it clear that in April we weren't in imminent danger of getting the grant revoked. We became in imminent danger when those two reports in June came to the federal government.
Okay, now there's some people who, people who want to join this conversation. Okay. Put your headphones on so we can hear from Tanya in Bowie, Maryland. Tanya, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you. I'm very upset about this because I have a child in the system. She's new to the system. I was at the school board meeting last night. It was a hot mess. Most of what happened behind closed doors. The board voted no outside investigation, and it voted that it would not appeal the loss of $6.5 million. That is ridiculous. I am an employment attorney, and I used to represent a child protection agency, so I understand privacy. I understand legal needs to be behind closed doors. But I also understand redaction. I also understand pulling information that the public does not need to know. But this seems to be about protection of the county versus protection of the students. And we keep talking about the teachers and the schools, but the issue here is that once this issue rose to the board, the failure to remedy is why the county lost money. The issue is on the board. It's not down at the school level. Bad things happen in the school, but the loss of money is because of the county's leadership failure to take action. And they need to come out into the sunlight and be more open with county residents.
You have talked, and the county executive has talked about holding the offenders responsible, but one of the other board members points out that it doesn't make sense for a school district to investigate itself. He says, and I suspect our caller Tanya would agree, that there needs to be an outside investigation, a state or federal investigation. How do you feel?
So I would be open to any investigation which helps us to remedy the situation, to find the answers about where systems failed and where individuals failed. I would be open to any investigation whatsoever about my own role and my own conduct. I am not going to begin to claim that there is no way that I made mistakes. I can only state emphatically that I made no effort to do anything other than work on the best interest of children and to do things legally and properly based on my obligations.
Got another caller, Anthony in Prince George's County. Anthony, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Kojo. Thanks for taking my call. This seems to be, to me, clearly a collusion between the county executive, the superintendent of schools, and the school board chairman to sweep this issue under the table for a long, long time, and not because of political relationships. This current superintendent, had he been a superintendent of color, he would have been thrown out of office by the current board. I can remember previous superintendents having less offensive issues in the school system, and the school board called for their hanging, if you will. for lack of a better word. So this superintendent has never been seen to address, never been called to address. The county executive is shielding him and the board.
So you are suggesting, Anthony, let me be clear, you are suggesting that because the school superintendent is white, the African-American county executives and the African-American board chair are somehow reluctant to sanction him?
Correct.
Why?
Because of political appointment. If this was a political appointment by the county executive.
Okay, but you seem to be saying that if it was a black superintendent, it would be different.
Yes, it would be.
Why?
As it has been before.
Why?
Let's cut past practices, Joe. Look at the past superintendent.
I'm afraid I can't accept that argument, but I'll let Sego Newbanks make his argument.
Look, I would only say that when you look at the history of Prince George's County Public Schools, you'll see that we had 8 superintendents over a 14-year period. That level of instability did us no favors as a district. It helped us maintain our status as the second to the bottom in most academic performance measures in the state. And if we can maintain a sense of stability and leadership over time.
You can't put stability over performance, I guess, is the point that Anthony
you can make. You can be consistently bad.
Right.
So, Superintendent, let's move this ahead politically, because it is a political decision and it affects Rashern Baker, who's running for governor. Is the superintendent involved in this group, this committee that's been formed to decide where Head Start, the program, should go? That's a small committee, I think. You met yesterday or this morning, I can't remember when. Where this committee is made up of you and the county executive, and when you're going to, what's the committee going to do? Decide who's going to get the contract next? And how quickly will that be decided?
The committee is going to be made up of representatives of the Board of Education, representatives from administration, and representatives from county
government.
We'll
be there. Already there, right?
I'm not part of it. They started this morning, but I'm not.
Okay. Okay. Yeah, now, what are they doing? They're deciding where it's going to go.
Well, the administration for children and families ultimately decides where it's going to go.
Well, I know, but you have to. The county has to make a recommendation. They don't just come in and set up an independent
that's the point.
Shop.
So we're gonna put together a look at all of our options and come up with a set of recommendations.
No, we, not you, this committee.
We the board, right? The committee that includes board members, and it will.
How quickly will that board act? I mean, this committee to what next for Head Start? How quickly will it decide to tell the federal government, okay, the Prince George's schools are giving it up, and we want it to go to this agency or this group or this organization because it will do what the school system has not done. Do they have a deadline? I know how these committees work. They can last forever.
They cannot and won't last forever because we have an obligation to the administration for children and families. So until we talk with the administration for children and families, we haven't established a deadline. We just set the committee up last night. Although I would assume, given the importance that one, it happens quickly because the federal government has got to go out to a regranting process and they're going to go through that process.
You've said process enough times today to make my head swim.
So,
I just think if I were a parent with a child in this, I also know there are probably hundreds. I don't know how many instructors there are in the Head Start program. Do you have a number off the top of your head?
There are about 110 or so.
And 100 plus of those have not been sticking children's head in their own urine.
Absolutely.
And making them little kids walk down the hall. So
absolutely.
This sounds to me like we've got a good program maybe that's going on. This sounds like the management of it's terrible. And if I hear the word process one more time, my head is just
Well, you won't hear it because we do have to move on. Students return to school this week, and there's a lot to be excited about, but there are challenges. It's Maryland's second largest school district, but also ranks near the bottom of the state in terms of performance. What are the biggest areas the school district you think needs to be focused on now?
So we need to focus on several of the areas that we started with our 5-year strategic plan that focus on literacy, that focused on graduation rates, that focused on kindergarten readiness, that focused on expanded pre-K and access to pre-K. So again, the Head Start issue created a significant challenge with that, but we still have 3 or 4 times as many pre-K classrooms as we had 3 years ago. We are focused on parent engagement in ways that we never have before. Next week, we launch the Family Institute, which is one of our new initiatives. Last year, we launched an parent ombudsman's office. We opened an office of family and community engagement. So the board has really been focused on doing more and more things to expand parent and family and community engagement. So I think we're really excited about what the Family Institute will do. It's going to provide additional services to parents around 21st century learning, health and wellness, higher quality professional learning for staff about how to better engage with families and communities.
None of that was being done before this Family Institute, or is this a reshuffling of bureaucratic agencies within the schools to do this more directly?
Surely
these things were being done before.
The restructuring of the family and community engagement happened, but this is new work. We hadn't explicitly had an institute where we were inviting parents in to help them work with us around a set of skills around health and wellness, around 21st century skills. Okay. And so, yes, this is new.
There are other specific questions that people have. Here's Renee in Largo, Maryland. Renee, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, yes. First, I want to commend the school system with not having a break in the Head Start program, and the kids are going to be able to attend school on the 29th. But I wanted to focus more on the grading policy, the new grading policy that will affect the kids, all the children in Prince George's County. I just wanted information about that.
Where can Renee get information about the new grading policy? What's changed about it?
So we implemented a new grading policy this year that affects middle and high school students in particular, and that focused on moving us more to a standards-based grading policy, which essentially means where we want the academic grades of students to reflect their academic knowledge, and that things like behavior and other things do not become part of a student's academic grade.
Is it tougher for someone to get a grade now or easier?
So I think that the new grading policy gives our students more opportunities to prove their academic knowledge than they previously did.
And what does that mean?
That means that students who have perpetually not taken care of their business are going to continue to fail. But students, for example, we have, I mean, I can get into the technicalities.
Across the country, there's been some efforts to have students not fail, that they'll get grades that allow them to go forward. It's almost social promotion.
Right.
This is the opposite of that.
This is about students having clear demonstration of the academic knowledge and the academic standards, and that becomes their grade, rather than a lot of times grades have a lot that are in them. If a student is tardy, if a student acts up in class, there are ways to deal with that. But if that becomes part of the academic grade, what the chemistry grade should reflect is what a student knows about chemistry.
Unique to Prince George's County, or is this a system you've adapted from somewhere else?
It is not unique. It's similar to the one that's already in place in Montgomery County. Fairfax County put it in, and it's happening in
systems across the
country.
We have one more specific question from Adrian, because we're running out of time. Adrian, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. My name is Dr. Adrian Collier, and I'm a pediatrician in Prince George's County. I live in Bowie, Maryland, and my daughter attends Tulip Grove Elementary School. 2 years ago, the children were moved from their permanent school to the YMCA on Moylan Drive. 2 years ago, we were told that they would be entering into their new renovated school this school year. School started on Tuesday. There have been no permits approved. No bids have been approved. No construction has been started on the new school.
Well, we'll have Sigourney Eubanks bring you up to date about what's going on at Tulip Grove Elementary School.
The Tulip Grove Elementary School project was indeed supposed to be completed by now, but there have been significant challenges with getting the bidding process done. We had a bid process that was completed and was prepared to be brought to the board actually at the meeting last night, but it was pulled off the agenda because there was protest made to the bid, and when the lawyers looked at it, they said we needed to go out to bid.
This is a school that was supposed to be remodeled, open this year, so it's been more than 2 years of just trying to get somebody to do the work?
So some of the work has started, but we are significantly behind schedule with that.
How many other schools are behind schedule?
We have when you look at what's behind schedule with the $2 billion worth of work that needs to be done in our schools to bring them up to code, but we are getting ready to open. We are right on schedule for our new high school. We are moving to several new middle schools, so we are very serious about the work that we need to do about.
Well, we're talking about doing the work. What schools have been redone? Can you just tick off five schools that have been redone?
I can't without having my CIP.
What is CIP?
Look, I'm sorry. I've been a board chair for a long time.
You need capital to come back to reality here. Yes. What is CIP quickly?
The capital improvement program, building programs, yes.
You know why people call this a hot mess. You know, the first caller called it a hot mess talking about Head Start, and now we've talked about the construction of the schools and then the allegation that it's all politics. Is it all politics?
So I'm not a politician. I don't think
you said
this
that
is
twice. You know, politicians. You know, so, you're a political appointee. That's called politics.
So the work of bringing a school system that is already pretty good but needs to be significantly better is not an easy work. We're a $2 billion operation with 129,000 students, 209. Buildings and a history of underperformance, and so the work of making that transformation happen is not easy. But I would not call it
you
all
seem
politics.
Almost you too nice
gotta go. Segun Eubanks is
nice
the chair of the
job.
Prince George's County Board of Education. He's also the director of professional educator support at the National Education Association. You're in a hot seat. Thank you for sitting in this hot seat today.
Thank you, Kojo, for having me.
You're more than welcome. Tom Sherwood is our resident analyst. He's a reporter for NBC4 and a columnist with the Current Newspapers. Tom Sherwood, there was another emergency board meeting of Metro yesterday, and it's kind of difficult to figure out exactly what they discussed, exactly what's going on, except that regardless of the changes, things just don't seem to be working right.
Well, you know, that's not news. Hello. I mean, Metro makes Prince George's school situation look great. And as Dr. Eubanks leaves, thank you very much, sir. Metro, they had the good news is they had a 2.5-hour meeting where they clearly discussed things and about what needed to be done. They talked about, but it's just, I think we've heard enough meetings, and I would like to hear announcements of things that have been improved, and we've had all these safe track things.
To be a list of what's working right.
I want to know, you know, what's working. I want to know if the wide gauges, which I call the wide stance of the metro, the tracks don't hold up when people go around sharp curves, and so the trains go off the tracks. It seems to me that would be good. This meeting was good. I compliment the general manager, Paul Wedefeld, and his chief operating officer and the safety officer for answering questions for 2.5 hours. But people, I think, want to know that if I go into the metro system, will I come out?
And will I come out safely?
And it's 40 years of virtual neglect by every person who's ever been elected and served on that board will not be fixed in 40 days or 40 nights, but we ought to at least start hearing some positive news.
Joining us in studio now is Carl Roller. He is the chair of Advisory Neighborhood Commission 3C. Carl Roller, thank you for joining us.
Kojo, thank you. It's my pleasure.
A group of residents in Ward 3 have filed a lawsuit against Mayor Bowser and the D.C. Council over a plan for a homeless shelter in your ANC district. First, tell us a little bit about the plans for this shelter. How big would it be? Where would it be located?
Sure, absolutely. The shelter in its current proposed location would be on Idaho Avenue, sharing the lot with the 2nd District Police Headquarters. In fact, it would be built over the parking lot of the police headquarters.
How many people would be would the shelter be able to accommodate?
It would accommodate up to 50 families.
And can be any number. It can be 2, 3, 4, or 5.
Correct.
You are not a party to this lawsuit. Why not?
Through mostly a quirk of D.C. law, ANCs are prohibited from bringing lawsuits against the city, even when it comes to violations of the ANC Act.
Because there would be, there are 36 ANCs around the city, if they could bring suit.
Yes.
they have the intricate knowledge of their neighborhoods. They could bring a heck of a lot of suits.
You do represent, however, the residents of ANC 3. So what are the issues with this homeless shelter?
Sure. Well, and also to be a little more specific, I'm both the chair of ANC3C as well as the commissioner for the SMD, which specifically includes the proposed site. Yes. I want to be clear first. I know some of the coverage has tried to portray a lot of the concerns in opposition as being opposed absolutely to a shelter at this location. And I know for myself, for my colleagues on the ANC, and for many of the neighbors and residents I talk to, that's actually not the case. We are not absolutely opposed to a shelter at this location.
Why should people believe that when a group has filed suit to stop it?
Sure.
I mean, I haven't heard them say, we want the shelter here, but we want to just adjust the process. I hadn't heard that.
Well, for anyone who's interested, and I'll talk about a couple of points in it, in June, ANC3C passed a resolution. It's available on our website, ANC3C.org. It set forth a number of points and concerns. To summarize sort of the biggest ones, I would say we have concerns about how enrollment in the schools are going to be handled. Particularly at John Eaton Elementary. We have concerns about the impact on the operations at Second District Headquarters. And we also have concerns about the feasibility of co-locating a shelter with a police station.
Did the resolution
ever say at any point, we, the residents of ANC3C, welcome a homeless shelter in our neighborhood?
Yes. Said actually, that. The very first point reiterated
you
a point.
You didn't say that.
Reiterated a point we actually made in March, which is that we absolutely believe and support the plan to close DC General. And that we support the mayor's, now sort of the mayor's and the council's plan to distribute the shelters, smaller shelters, throughout the eight wards.
Here's what I don't understand. I used to live in Ward 3, and I'm familiar with this location on Idaho Avenue. There's tremendous development around there on Macomb Street and Wisconsin Avenue. Is that the mayor came up with a proposal, the elected leaders of the council voted what their version of it should be, and now it's going forward. But in order to have a homeless shelter, it's not really supposed to be, it's more than a shelter. It's not just a day shelter. It's where people actually will live, like apartments, condo apartments.
It's a homeless residence.
It's a residence, not a shelter. And that this proposal will now go before the Zoning Commission because there are zoning issues involved. And it also will go before the ANC for it can be given great weight and fully vetted. And the Zoning Board will have to approve all those issues you talked about will impact on the police and on the schools at Eaton and all those. And that's the way the process works. It seems to me this lawsuit is peremptory. It's the cart before the horse. Why not engage in the process? I mean, they announced they're going to put a shelter there. Then you have all the process. There's that word again. Follows
would
through.
You mind if Pat answers that question? Because Pat identifies herself as a plaintiff in the lawsuit. So, Pat, you are on the air. You heard Tom Sherwood's question. What would be your answer?
Thank you. First of all, I appreciate I enjoy your show a lot. I'm glad to be here. I would like to correct a couple of things that Tom seems to assume about this lawsuit. And I do echo Carl in terms of where the mindset of the neighborhood is. This is not we're against having a shelter there under any circumstances. We're trying to understand if there are answers to some issues that we've tried to raise, but that we were not permitted to raise before the council acted. The lawsuit does not seek to stop the shelter. What the lawsuit seeks to do is to say, look, there is a statute that mandates that before there is a change in use of land in the District of Columbia, the council and any agency in the city government must first consult with the Advisory Neighborhood Commission. The council failed to do that. The council acted completely on its own without following the statute that requires it to consult.
My understanding is the elected body, the Council of the District of Columbia, proposes legislation and passes legislation to do all types of things, but it is the government agencies that cannot act without getting the great weight of the ANCs. It's not that the council has to have the great weight of the ANCs on everything it passes down at the council or that the mayor proposes. They decide they want to put a shelter there, then they have to go through all the ANCs and the zoning commission and everything else to see if it can be feasible, it can be done there. It's not a violation for the council to pass a law. I mean, I don't think so. I'm not a lawyer, are you?
Yeah, I am a lawyer.
Okay, good. Well, how is that possible?
And we've hired a lawyer who is prosecuting the lawsuit, who is an expert in this area. Well, and our considered opinion is that, in fact, when it involves, it's not every act that the council passes. If they want to pass a tax bill, that's different. But when they pass something that directly affects the use of land, and this is changing the use of land at that property, they need to consult. And
they can't change the land unless they go to the zoning commission, though. That it can't. The council can't vote to change it. It has to be approved.
And what Tom seems to be suggesting is that when this goes before the zoning commission, the community will have more than ample opportunity to have its voice heard.
Well, I don't think the community is going to have an opportunity to overturn the selection of the site.
Well, the zoning commission can do that.
I don't believe the zoning commission can do that. I don't believe the zoning commission has the authority to say no. They can say, okay, you can only build two stories, or you can only have a bigger driveway.
Well, your leader is raising his hand here. He wants to speak. Carl Rober.
It's radio, Carl.
I know. The raising the hand doesn't make much of a difference. With respect to the zoning process, the BZA, per the regulations, is able to consider basically three general categories: traffic, noise, and operations.
That sounds exactly like what the residents are worried about.
Well, it's not exactly just what the ANC is worried about, though. I can't speak for Pat or her group, but when we raise concerns about the public schools, when we raise concerns about the feasibility of co-locating the shelter with the police station with respect to the residents of the shelter itself, those are not BZA considerations.
What is the concern with locating it at the same site as the police station?
Sure. As I was soliciting input from the community about this, one of the pieces of feedback I received through a resident was from someone who had herself experienced homelessness. And when she heard that the shelter was going to be put onto the same site as a police station with officers, and I want to emphasize the officers of the District of Columbia, the MPD, I have no doubt, I have absolute faith in their professionalism, but she expressed a grave concern about the appearance of criminalizing homelessness by the appearance of thinking that the only way that the shelter would work within this community was to put it on top of a police station. And there's been plenty of reports in the local media as well as national media about tensions between people experiencing homelessness and the police in terms of loitering laws being used to rouse people experiencing homelessness. So I think there are some concerns there. I think they could be addressed.
Do you have a suggestion
I have to answer that. There is no indication that the police department of this city harasses homeless people.
No, Tom, I didn't say that.
Well, that's what the suggestion was, that it will criminalize homelessness, and that they will be watched over like, caretakers of homeless people coming and going. I just don't think
But Tom, I think that's a mischaracterization of what I was saying.
Oh, well, say again what you just said, because I thought it was pretty clear.
That the concerns that I heard from someone who herself had experienced homelessness is that it creates a perception of criminalizing homelessness on the part of the people themselves experiencing homelessness.
She said it. Do you agree with it?
I'm not experiencing homelessness. I don't know how it would feel to be in those shoes and be sitting right next to
the police
station.
Some homeless people would say they would love to have the police protection there because they will feel safer when they're out on the street during the day if they're not in those homes.
So one of the things we asked for on the ANC was some sort of a study or expert report on whether or not that was feasible, whether that was fair, whether it was a concern that was shared, and we've gotten absolutely no answer on that from the council.
We got a tweet from Sally who says, I was at the first meeting of the group regarding a Ward 3 shelter. They were opposed from the beginning. Indeed, the group changed its name from a name with opposed in it At the first meeting, the very first meeting, a lawyer recommended a suit like this. Do you recall that at all?
Now it's called Neighbors for Responsible Government.
Was it called Neighbors Opposed to Something Else before?
You know, Carjo, I think there have been three or four different groups, and I can't speak for every group or every resident.
So there might be some confusion here. You met with the Department of Human Services Director Laura Zeilinger.
Correct.
You say that meeting went well?
It was constructive. It was refreshingly honest, and it was helpful in a lot of respects. So, yes, I think there's actually a good relationship there, and I have a lot of respect for the director's professionalism and expertise.
Now, I think Mary Che, the council member for Ward 3, I think she's told people, and I think she said some of this to me, that there have been meetings. There was a meeting at Stoddart. There was a meeting at the Hebrew synagogue. That there were community meetings about this to discuss what the council had done or was doing. And again, the purpose, the suit, if the suit is successful, what will happen? Everything will stop, and what happens? I don't understand what the goal of the suit is.
When it comes to the lawsuit, you know, the ANC is not a party to it. I'm not a party to it.
What's your understanding? I'll give you outsider opportunity.
You only got about a minute left.
Yeah, I'm happy to leave that to the lawyers in the court.
It's my understanding that while the council hasn't addressed your concerns, the council has apparently agreed to form an advisory committee. What's that all about?
Yes, sir. So the advisory committee would consist of a few members from the ANC and a few other residents in the neighboring area, Director Zeilinger, a representative from MPD, and would address, as I understand it, basically issues as they come up.
So the bottom line of this is the council said that it wants to put a homeless shelter there, and now it has to go through the whole process, again, that word, to see if whether it's going to get done. And that's where the citizens can either fight it, change it, or oppose it, or do whatever they want to do. But that's the way the system works. I'm still mystified by this lawsuit.
Welcome
more information.
Will have to see what happens as the lawsuit goes forward, because we are, just about out of time. Carl Roller is the chair of the Advisory Neighborhood Commission 3C, where that homeless residence is scheduled to be located. Thank you very much for joining us.
Kojo, Tom, thank you both.
Thank you.
That's it for the show today, but remember there's always more online and in person. Mark your calendars for next Tuesday evening when producer Taylor Burney will be talking with author and Washington Post reporter Neely Tucker at Politics and Prose. They'll discuss Tucker's latest novel, Only the Hunted Run, the third in his Sully Carter series, starting at 7 p.m. at Politics and Prose on Connecticut Avenue. Be there. Visit WAMU.org/events for details. And it's going to be another really hot weekend, perfect for you to binge listen to the show and catch up on broadcasts you've missed. Do it via your favorite podcast app or by exploring our archives at kojoshow.org. However you listen, be sure to meet us back here Monday at noon. Montgomery County's police chief joins us to discuss challenges in an era of tension between law enforcement and the communities they serve. That's coming up Monday at noon. Until then, enjoy the weekend. And Tom Sherwood, you work last weekend covering the Trump rally in Virginia. You say the crowd was very sedate.
Yeah, so there have been reports of how the crowd has been turned on the media, me and others. I was there, out of the several thousand people who were there inside and out, I just found people who were concerned, whether you agree with them on politics. Not one person yelled, screamed, or did anything that would suggest a rudeness, and I liked it.
That's because of your calm, unabrasive personality. That's a lie. Thank you all for listening. I'm Kojo Nandi.
The Kojo Nandi Show is produced by Michael Martinez, Ingalisa Schroepsdorf, Taylor Burney, Ruth Tam, Elizabeth Weinstein, Avery Kleiman, and Raynell Cooper. The engineer is Meg Bunting. Podcasts of all shows and audio archives are available at our website, kojoshow.org.